I'm your host, Brent Metcalf. Let's talk Mormon Studies.
Come a day, you see the sun.
Today's guest is one of my favorite Mormon historians, and in addition, happens to be one of my dearest friends. We're welcoming Dan Vogel to the Mormon Studies podcast, and Dan is, I think most would agree, that he's one of the most prolific authors on Mormon studies. He has made significant, influential contributions to Mormon history and our understanding, not simply of recreating the history the best we can, but also in understanding the documents that often lie and undergird various theories that historians propose. So one of the volumes and sets that Dan has put together is Early Mormon Documents, which is a five-volume work that basically chronicles almost every major document dealing with the foundational era of Mormonism. And it is a must-have for every serious student of Mormonism. And I remember Dan from, Dan, I'm trying to remember here. I think we probably first met around 1980 or so. And I remember having all these conversations about Indian origins in the Book of Mormon. And I was thinking the other day that I probably still have three or four manuscript drafts of your book. It's just been so long that we've known each other, and we've had such an enjoyable friendship and been able to exchange ideas on a variety of scholarly issues. And I welcome you to the program. Thank you for being on, Dan.
Well, thank you, Brent. We've known each other for over 30 years, it seems like. I remember meeting you. It was shortly after your mission. And you didn't have the muscles that you have now, but I remember meeting you really clearly, and yeah. So I've really enjoyed our friendship over these years too, also, and being able to bounce ideas off of you. I would say that out of all of my friends, we're probably, you know, have the same general approach to historical issues, and so. Kind of a
camaraderie.
Yeah, a camaraderie.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, I really, you know, like I said, like to bounce ideas off of you. And you always have a vigorous, you know, intellectual analysis of things, so that I enjoy very much.
Well, I appreciate that. And the feeling is mutual. When I've worked on very difficult issues in the past and tried to understand complex historical scenarios, you've always been there as a person that I could talk to and just say, let's have a sanity check here. Am I even in the ballpark
right. And
discussing this issue? And I think that that's something that numerous scholars could benefit from, and I'm sure that they do with their colleagues and peers. And I've just thoroughly enjoyed that relationship with you. Our whole format here is that we try and keep it to a fairly digestible chunk of information. So I've tried to keep the interviews to about an hour or so long. So we have a lot of ground to cover. And the first thing that I would like you just to chat about is, what are some of the current projects that you're working on right now? And then we'll get to one that you just recently published.
Right. Well, you know, my day right now, I'm working on the Wilford Woodruff journals and trying to prepare a typescript for the Smith Pettit Foundation. They're trying to redo the old Wilford Woodruff journals that Scott Kinney did many years ago, and is it way out of print for a long time. And they're trying to get a more scholarly apparatus involved with the text. Bring it up to what currently our practices are now. And so that's what I do I've been working on that for just over 3 years. And I'm also preparing a publication of a critical edition of the history of the church, which will be an 8-volume set that should be out by the end of the year. We're up to printing volume 5 right now. So this would be a critical text where all of the manuscript sources and also the sources that they use to compile the history will be identified in footnotes.
And just to let listeners know who may not have all the background information, to give listeners some background information too, is that I think many folks have grown up with the idea that Joseph Smith was the author of the history of the church, or at least that's the authorial attribution that's given to the volumes, when in actual fact, it's a compilation done by various historians of numerous sources, some that may come directly from Joseph Smith, and in other cases, some that don't. And so I think the work that you're doing there is just absolutely critical for historians in understanding not only the history of early Mormonism, but the formation of this document that has come to be known as the history of the church.
Yeah, well, actually, it has taken me about 10 years to do this work. I mean, the footnotes will note every variant reading of, you know, every passage in the history of the church. The first 6 volumes cover Joseph Smith's life, and the 7th volume was added later with the various other documents. I discuss that, but I don't reproduce it in any way. So the first 6 volumes cover Joseph Smith's life, and it was begun in 1838 and then finally finished in 1857 in Utah. And a lot of people don't know what they're looking at when they're reading out of this volume. So there's a lot of uncertainty as to the authority of some of these passages. So identifying where they come from is a very important thing to know. And then how that passage may differ from the original source is also listed in the footnotes.
There's nothing, I think, that's more awkward than that moment for a historian who's attributed something to Joseph Smith, only to find out that it's actually taken from a newspaper clipping that wasn't written by him or really had anything to do with him in terms of its authorial content. And so I think that something like that is a great service.
Well, I certainly hope so, of course. You never know. You're always, apprehensive about how it will be received by the scholarly community. I hope it is received well, of course. Anyway, that's kind of what I'm working on day to day.
I'm looking forward to reading my copy. Let's talk a little bit about one of your most recent publications, which is a project that you worked on for Signature Books. It's an annotated version of Ebert E. Howe's Mormonism Unveiled. And if you could just give a little bit of background on why is Howe's book important and why did Signature Books go about creating an annotated version? I mean, why even bother doing that with a book that came out in 1834?
Well, it's distinguished by the fact that it's the first book-length treatment of the contradicts the Joseph Smith's version of things. So it has that, and it's a very rare book, and it's only been available in really poor photocopies. But it still has, even though it's written so long ago, it still has very valuable documents to scholars and very firsthand accounts of people who knew Joseph Smith back in Palmyra and Manchester and Harmony, Pennsylvania. So those are important to keep people in touch with. And this scholarly edition that Signature has just put out has annotations and footnotes and things, so that it puts a lot of things in context, because you really don't know where any of that's coming from either. It's got a lot of different, pulls together a lot of different sources from newspapers, some of the things that Howe wrote in his newspaper, the Painesville Telegraph. It has correspondence with, W.W. Phelps, with Charles Anthon in it. So it has a lot of value still to historians. And a lot of the topics he brings up, we're still debating today.
And I would have to say that I think one of the most invaluable things about Howe's book is that he is a first generation reader of the Book of Mormon. And he has written a very detailed analysis coming from his perspective of somebody who lived in the culture at the time, even if he was antagonistic in many ways. He is still bringing the eyes of his culture to this book. And those readings become particularly interesting in that context, because when you go back to what Howe was writing when he was editor for the Painesville Telegraph, and some of his comments about the Book of Mormon then, they're pretty uninformed. And at that point, I suspect that he had never even read the Book of Mormon. But then by the time he writes his book, he has now read the book, and he's giving almost a chapter by chapter, or at least book by book, analysis of the content of the book from within his cultural perspective. And I think that that is just an absolutely invaluable thing that he's done. I mean, where else would we find somebody who's a reader of his time period giving us that level of analyses?
Right. You know, it takes up about 70 pages of Howe's book. And no matter what you believe about the origins of the Book of Mormon, the first readers are really important to understanding the intent of the book, actually, because Joseph Smith, even if he didn't write it, he translated it, is still trying to communicate to his generation, his readership. So how that relationship went is important to no matter to everybody, no matter what their position is on the Book of Mormon.
I agree. And it's because of that that Howe really does open a portal into the early 19th century to understand how somebody living in that world would have interpreted the content of the book as it relates to their culture at the time. And it's very clear from reading Howe that he saw certain things as being very specific references to cultural events that were happening within his milieu. And I think that that's something that, again, is just incredibly invaluable. And to Book of Mormon interpreters, you really do have to take Howe seriously as an initial reader of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, that's right. He was somewhat inspired by Alexander Campbell's 1831 critique of the Book of Mormon, which is along the same lines. The basic position that they take is that it addresses the political and religious issues of their day, which is different than a lot of the issues that we deal with. So sometimes the footnotes that I provide help readers to understand what the political and religious issues were that Howe is talking about, and why he sees them as being reflected in the Book of Mormon. And a lot of times we need that help because, like I said, you know, we don't have issues, political issues over Masonry, let's say, and he sees the Book of Mormon as reflecting the anti-Masonic politics of Western New York at the time that followed the murder of William Morgan in 1826. And what made it more, heated at the time was in 1828, right when Joseph Smith is getting, he dictated the Lost 116 pages in 1828, but he's also getting ready in 1829 to dictate this text, is right after Andrew Jackson got elected. And Andrew Jackson was a Mason, and the anti-Masons took advantage of that. And there was a lot of anti-Masonic, rhetoric flying around at the time Joseph Smith dictating this book, right there in the hotbed of anti-Masonry in Western New York, within miles of where Morgan was murdered.
In fact, one of the comments that Howe makes is he references the Nephites are represented as being anti-Masons and Christians, which carries with it some evidence that the writer foresaw the politics of New York in 1828 to 29. So he dates it very specifically. the content to Joseph Smith's era, which in and of itself is pretty fascinating given what a certain portion of his book is going to be dealing with, which we can talk about in a minute. What other particular things do you think stand out to you? We have the Ezra Booth letters are reproduced. What other things stand out?
We can't forget the Charles Anthon letters, which you've done some work on recently, some interesting work. So this is like E.D. Howe contacted Charles Anthon in 1831 to ask him about these rumors about the Mormons saying that he verified that the characters on the plates were Reformed Egyptian. And he denied that and in this letter to Howe. So it's that's a very valuable letter. Now we have two other letters that are very interesting to have in the same connection.
Of course, Erin, my wife, has done considerable work on the letters of Charles Anthon, and she's actually, I guess, discovered one of the other letters, and there is just great insight into that early period that we wouldn't have had otherwise if it weren't for the curiosity of Howe. But that raises another interesting question, Dan. What motivated Howe? What were the reasons that were behind him wanting to create this volume? Because like you said, here he is in 1831, contacting Charles Anthon, and it's like, why is he doing that? What's going on? What's happening in his world that would even lead him in that direction?
Oh, that's a very good question. Howe knew about the Mormons through newspaper accounts like Palmyra Reflector with Abner Cole and his publication there in Palmyra. He found out about the Gold Bible and started writing on it in his newspaper before the Mormon missionaries even showed up. But they did show up in about October of 1830, and with Oliver Cowdery and Parley P. Pratt and, you know, the so-called Lamanite mission. They stopped on their way to Missouri. They stopped into the Kirtland area, where Parley P. Pratt was a minister before he became a Mormon. And they preached and they converted. Of course, everybody knows this story. They converted Sidney Rigdon and his whole congregation right there in 1830 in November and December. And so that started him off and running. And but, you know, he probably didn't realize at the time that his wife would be converted also to Mormonism. We're not sure of the date, but it is, you know, sometime before 1834. And his sister. This, of course, raised the stakes. And, you know, you always wonder what the conversation was in Howe's household with his wife being a Mormon. And a very interesting conversations, and that we can probably surmise some of the content by reading his book. So, and then with the, you know, he could hardly avoid the issue. He's only 10 miles away in Painesville, and the Mormons are, you know, building this huge community in the Kirtland area. And when we only have the history of the Mormons to 1834 in his book, of course, they go on, and this is like before any of the bank problems in 1837 and 38. And the Mormons leave the area in 1830. Joe Smith does, you know, and most of the Mormons are leaving the area in 1839 to go to Missouri. So, you know, he's highly interested in the subject.
So in a very real sense, he has a front row seat to the activities of this burgeoning religion. And he's watching what's happening in Kirtland and where, of course, they're going to build a temple. Eventually leading to the entire model of gathering and so on. Kirtland was really the place that prefigured all of that in Joseph Smith's theology. So that was going to change in the whole landscape. So one of the other themes that I find interesting and you've mentioned is that Ebert E. Howe sees anti-Masonic influence in the Book of Mormon, which is really interesting because initially when he's talking about the Book of Mormon in the Painesville Telegraph, he seems to take almost the opposing view, and that somehow that the Book of Mormon is related to Masonry. Then it's only upon reading the book that he finally determines, yeah, this looks like there's anti-Masonic influence in it. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. He assumed that the Mormons were Masons because the Book of Mormon was printed on a Masonic press. It was printed, you know, by Grandin in Palmyra, but Grandin was Joseph's second choice, actually. He initially went to Rochester and tried to get it published by an anti-Masonic, Thurlow Weed, in Rochester. There was the center of anti-Masonry was Thurlow Weed in Rochester. And Thurlow Weed turned him down and thought it was a bunch of nonsense. So Joseph Smith went to Grandin in the printing press there. He printed also the Wayne Sentinel. And they were very much pro-Mason. And what I mean by pro-Mason is that they supported Andrew Jackson in 1828. So, and that's kind of how the division went, that a lot of presses sprung up just for the 1828 election, and they were known as, you know, pro-Mason and anti-Mason presses, and they were very opinionated kind of presses. Edie Howe assumed that it was must have been a pro-Mason book. But when he read it, of course, it became very clear to him that it was just the opposite was the case. And it talked about secret combinations and secret signs and, you know, plots against the government and things like that. So he's probably, some would probably say he's biased towards that interpretation and therefore he gave it, or that he was just the very type of person that you would want interpreting the Book of Mormon at that time. So I think this is, of course, I've written on it and I've published on the Book of Mormon being anti-Masonic or full of anti-Masonic rhetoric. And Martin Harris interpreted it as anti-Masonic, even called it, according to one newspaper, the anti-Masonic Bible.
Right. I think that was in the Jaga Gazette.
That's right.
If I remember correctly. That's, again, incisive background that you're not going to find from modern day readers who tend, I think, frequently read the Book of Mormon text with presentist assumptions. Mm-hmm. That the text reflects their own current theology rather than issues and concerns of that day. And even though the Book of Mormon itself is constantly talking about the people in the time when the book comes forth.
Right. Well, the Book of Mormon, I would say, isn't just anti-Masonic. It's anti-Masonry was just part of its overall stance against Jackson. And which a lot of the religious people saw Jackson as a Mason, as with a substitute type religion taking over the United States and the government. And a lot of times the anti-Masonry stuff drowns out how the Book of Mormon in other ways criticized what was going on in America at the time the book appeared. And Jackson's election to the presidency was seen as this terrible transition in American history. Of course, we all survived it and it went on. But the same similar things were said about Thomas Jefferson when he came into office with the Illuminati and things like that. But then that kind of died out, and then Masonry picked up on that Illuminati, anti-Illuminati furor and went on with it.
Now, Howe also captures a number of early revelations on Mormonism. He mentions Ezra Booth's letters, and those include copies of Revelations and so on. What benefit do scholars gain from having access to some of those copies that he's reproduced?
Well, some of them come from placards or handbills that they handed out of the early revelations. Some come from manuscript sources. Ezra Booth was able to read some of the early manuscript revelations and report on them that we don't have those versions of anymore. You know, say like DNC 17, which is a revelation given about the three witnesses, and that one wasn't published until 1835, Doctrine and Covenants, but it's evident to anyone that reads it that it's been edited and some things added to it and words that are anachronistic to the 1829 setting have been added to it, like Urim and Thummim. But Ezra Booth reported on that revelation early on about what it meant to the witnesses having a vision of the plates, that it was more not a daylight kind of literal vision, that it was more like a Quaker has impressions. Anyway, there are some wording differences, and the Joseph Smith Papers people picked up on some of the revelations that Ezra Booth printed and some of the different wordings on it, and said that he did have access to earlier versions than we have now.
That is really great information. What types of unique historical events does Howe capture in his book? I know, for example, in an article I published a number of years ago, that I mentioned that he references in a fairly specific way the Zelph revelation that Joseph Smith received. And there were other things I know that you've noted in there as well that Howe also captured. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Science Camp was the big thing that happened right before he published his book in 1834. And Science Camp, of course, everybody knows, I guess, that about 250 Mormons in the Ohio area and around about other states gathered together to go redeem Zion in 1834. By that, I mean that the Mormons had been kicked out of, Jackson County, where Independence, Missouri was. This was a big crisis, you know, in the church, because Joseph Smith's prophecy centered on reestablishing the New Jerusalem in Independence, Missouri, and now they're kicked out of that land, and the prophecies can't be fulfilled, so it was urgent that they try to regain that land. And so Joseph Smith gathered up, you know, Zion, you know, kind of a paramilitary kind of organization. And they marched from Ohio to Missouri to reestablish the Mormons in Jackson County. Because he didn't get support from the government that he expected, he didn't succeed in that mission, and the prophecies were left kind of unfulfilled and hanging, and so a lot of fallout. Joseph Smith experienced a lot of fallout from that, both in Missouri and when he returned to Ohio, which Howe reports on that fallout and people accusing him of being a false prophet. But on the way, you know, when they're doing their little marches and their pretend skirmishes, military skirmishes to practice taking back Jackson County. They did happen upon a mound, one of these Indian mounds that are so frequent in the Midwest. And I believe it's somewhere in Illinois. They dug down and they found a skeleton, and Joseph Smith receives a revelation that this is Zelph, a white Lamanite, according to, you know, several of the members of the camp, including Wilford Woodruff and Heber C. Kimball, Moses Martin, and some others. And this prophecy said that he was, under the prophet Onondagas, which is kind of an Indian name, one of the Indian seven Indian nations, actually, in New York. So another thing that links or gives us insight on this is a letter he wrote to Emma Smith, saying that they had wandered over the plains of the Nephites and discovered their bones to the as evidence of the divine authenticity of the Book of Mormon. So this is a very interesting episode that a lot of maybe apologists try to downplay and or try to reinterpret so that it's, you know, after the Book of Mormon time period or something like that. But it is, like I said, problematic for those who want to limit Book of Mormon events to Central America and not see Zelf as part of the last, what the, you know, the history of the church puts down as the last struggle.
Right.
Of the Lamanites and the Nephites on the hill Cumorah, it mentions, and that, yeah, Anandagus was a prophet that was renowned for from the Rocky Mountains to the hill Cumorahs, how it states in the history of the church, which is inspired by those two journal entries by Wilford Woodruff and Heber C. Kimball.
And what's interesting, too, Dan, is how rapidly the information about Zion's camp, about the Zelf revelation, was circulating. Because Howe is publishing in November of 1834. That's when his book comes out. And yet the revelation about Zelf is on June 3rd of 1834. And so there's a very, very short window of opportunity for him to have found out this information. And I'm just fascinated at how rapidly the rumors are already circulating about what had happened on that journey and what that journey entailed.
Yeah. Well, of course, the members of that camp, I mean, there's 250, but I don't know how many come back to the Kirtland, Ohio area, but quite a few. He doesn't name any of his sources, really, for where he gets a lot of his information, but the people are like right there in his environment. It was probably, you know, since it was, you know, proof of the divine authenticity of the Book of Mormon, is something that they probably bragged about and didn't know that the apologists many, many years later would change the location of the Book of Mormon.
Well put. Now, let's see, with Ezra Booth, he also talks about some information about relating to the high priesthood and also talks about Joseph Smith's experiments with or interest in the Adamic language. And so what insights do you have on that?
Well, that's quite interesting because a lot of the early converts in Ohio before Joseph Smith got there were, and this is reported by Howe, were very enthusiastic about expressing their faith. And in the old revival fashion, they spoke in tongues and, you know, they swooned, you know, and fainted and carried on in the revival-like fashion about their new Mormon faith. And recently, this is discussed in more detail in the most recent issue of the Journal of Mormon History by Chris Smith, who talks about these Lamanite behaviors. They, in their enthusiasm and in their tongue speaking, they made it very Mormon, and they would speak Indian languages and act like what they thought the Lamanites would act, and or they would be preachers preaching to the Lamanites, the Indians, you know, they use that as a synonym, and they would preach to the Lamanites before they even got to Missouri to preach to them, and they imagined these great conversions, and they would even baptize, you know, act out these baptisms of Lamanite converts. But this is the tongue speaking, this is kind of the origin of the tongue speaking, but it eventually evolves into, after Joseph Smith put down this version of enthusiasm, he put down a lot of this as being inspired by the devil, actually. But then there were true, according to him, true tongue speaking, and it centered around the belief that it was the pure Adamic language that they spoke in the Garden of Eden, and they went so far as to write down some of the words and had even some of the symbols, as you know. some strange symbols, and then this symbol is for angels, and this is the word, you know, this is a symbol for God, and this is the word Amen for God, and this is a symbol for Christ, and this Amen, Son of Amen, that's what it means. So they were intrigued and by the gift of tongues, which that Joseph Smith eventually put the wraps on tongue speaking in Mormonism, because it eventually would cause problems, because anytime anybody spoke in tongues, they would take that as authoritative of whatever doctrine or issue they were speaking about in Missouri. And some of the people in Missouri started speaking in tongues, and it caused problems. And a lot of them were excommunicated over it because it challenged some of Joseph Smith's revelations.
And some of that early usage of glossolalia that you're talking about there, it's interesting how the pure language figures into this and how Joseph Smith's understanding of the pure language figures into it. Because like you mentioned, there are these documents that start showing up, like the letter from William W. Phelps to his wife, Sally, in which you have these characters drawn out with these various interpretations. And then over the head of it, it says that this is a sample of the pure language. And then you have an actual revelation by Joseph Smith that is also titled Sample of Pure Language that ends up in Revelation Book 1. And it seems to me that there is a very close connection between these early experiments with glossolalia and what ends up in these pure language documents. And these pure language documents seem to be a precursor to what's going to come in documents like the Egyptian and alphabet documents relating to the Book of Abraham, where the same basic type of methodology is being used, with a character in one column, a letter or sound in another column, and then an interpretation of what that means. And so it seems like all of that is moving in a direction. And in this case, what happens with the Book of Abraham manuscripts and so on is almost like the fruition of those earlier experimentations.
Yeah, so you have the pure Adamic language being displayed in tongue speaking. And then in Egyptian alphabet and grammar, you have like the corruption.
Correct.
the corrupt version of the pure Adamic language. So it's going to be a similar thing, and that's why I think you find, you know, there's some of the similar characters being carried over into that project. But the thing about tongue speaking is that there was a debate among revivalists about tongues and what it all means. Is it a real gift? What kind of gift was displayed on the day of Pentecost in the Bible? Did they just learn foreign languages and were able to speak foreign language, or did they speak some pure language maybe, and everybody understood the preacher in their own language? Some revivalists said it was all a bunch of gibberish and just religious excess, you know, enthusiasm. They called it enthusiasm as kind of a derisive term, religious enthusiasm displayed at some revivals. Some revivals were more orderly and, you know, less emotional display of the spiritual manifestation of the Spirit. And tongues was taken as a sign of the presence of the Spirit, and that implied that they had authority to baptize. This is what the early Mormon converts believed. And so they looked in the Mormon missionaries for a display of tongues as a sign of authority to baptize. So tongues was a gift, one of the gifts spoken of in the Book of Mormon, which is the reason why the early converts expected it. It more or less said, without tongues, without the manifestations of the Spirit, there's no faith. A lot of Mormons today, you know, probably will never hear this gift ever displayed, and a lot of them excuse it, its absence, as saying that the Mormon missionaries have the gift to learn different languages. But that's not how it was originally perceived. It was perceived like a lot of what you see the evangelists do in their revivals today. that, you know, are given this, you know, fluency in this unknown tongue. And they have recorded some of these tongue speakers today and analyzed it to see if there's any, you know, language or pattern being used, you know, syntax or grammar or some sort of sign that there's a language behind it, but they've never been able to discover one. And the early Mormons weren't any different. They spoke a language that didn't really have any meaning, but it was the key was all in the interpretation of tongues. So a lot of people believed that they had this gift because it was a very fluent kind of language that flowed out of them that they seemed not to have any control over. It sort of had an automaticity quality to it. And then the other person would interpret and the gift of tongues. And Joseph Smith early on linked, and in the Book of Mormon, linked the gift of translating with the gift of tongues and the interpretation of tongues. So the early Mormons, it was a big thing. Tongues was a big thing, but it died out because it actually posed a threat to the leadership and the structure that was quickly growing out of this early Mormon charismatic origins, was growing into an institution, and the institution needed stability.
You know, you make an interesting point, and that is that the early usage of tongues and the model of translation that Joseph Smith is adopting presupposes that the languages either being spoken or being translated are inaccessible through any other means than a divine means. This isn't something right. That is knowable through naturalistic methods, but it requires supernaturalistic intervention in order for these things to happen.
Exactly. Which is like the New Testament pattern of Paul's instruction not to speak in tongues unless there's an interpreter. So the Mormons, this is part of the Mormon heritage, this gift of tongues, and I wrote a piece on it many years ago with Scott Dunn.
Which is an outstanding article, by the way, and I encourage listeners to find that and read it.
Yeah, thanks. It was like a gift, early gift that the Mormons had. The Mormons were a very charismatic group, but like I said, a lot of this charisma in charismatic groups, when they form, this is a thing sociologists study on a regular basis, is that how charismatic groups quickly turn into institutions like early Christians did in order to bring stability, or else they'll splinter, you know, into 1,000 pieces because of the challenges from other charismatics within the group. So what I see is Joseph Smith developed kind of a moderate position where there's boundaries put on charisma, where it can be expressed without challenging the institution itself.
Excellent comments. So Eber D. Howe gives us a glimpse into early Mormonism, their rituals, their beliefs. But he wasn't alone in bringing together what ends up in his book. He also had someone, I don't think I would call him a co-author per se, but someone who was certainly a collaborator in certain regards, and that was Dr. Philastus Hurlbut. Can you give us a little bit of insight into him and what his contribution to Howe's book is and was?
The early Mormons tried to say that the book was really Philastus Hurlbut's book, but it's not even close to being true. All he did was collect affidavits and then hand the affidavits over to Howe. Most of the book is Howe by himself and things that he collected before and after Hurlbut's affidavit collecting. Hurlbut was like a convert of the early church in 1832. He became aware of it. And in 1833, he was sent on a mission to the East, and he learned about some of what we know as the Spalding theory. This Solomon Spalding story starts way before Mormonism, and in my view, really doesn't have anything to do with Mormonism. But some of the people that Solomon Spalding knew claimed that he had written a novel, a romance, that dealt with the origin of the American Indians, and that it was very, very similar to the Book of Mormon, that as they heard it explained from the preachers. Later they read the book and they started thinking that they remember some of the names, and some people said that it was exactly the same. But there's many problems with that, which we might be able to talk about. But Hurlbut heard these rumors and then decided to abandon his mission and go back to Ohio. And he actually became excommunicated, as he had confrontations with Joseph Smith over this. And he was hired by a group of, you know, the merchants in the northern Ohio area, and hired to go and do research and find out about who this Joseph Smith guy is, where did he come from, and more about his background. They were specifically looking for some, you know, negative reports on Joseph Smith. They had already heard negative reports through Abner Cole's newspaper, the Palmer Reflector, which Hal reproduced in his Painesville Telegraph. So they already knew that there were people signing affidavits before Hurlbut even went. But he went to Palmyra and started collecting affidavits of people who were Joseph Smith's old money-digging friends, neighbors. Some of the affidavits aren't that valuable because the people didn't know the Smiths all that well, just from in town. But others were very familiar with the Smith family because they were neighbors and fellow money diggers. And, you know, they dug money, drank together, hung out. So they knew Joseph Smith quite well. And then he went to Pennsylvania and interviewed Joseph Smith's father-in-law, Isaac Hale, who wasn't really happy with his daughter marrying Joseph Smith. And some of Emma's relatives in the area, who were mostly, you know, Methodists. And then he interviewed some of the, along the way, interviewed some of Spalding's relatives and former acquaintances. The problem is that the Spalding affidavits are basically based on, you know, memories at least 15 to 20 years old of a book that they heard read to them that many years ago that seems vaguely familiar, that became more familiar the more they talked about it. But the affidavits that Hurlbut collected from Smith's acquaintances in Palmyra, Manchester, and Harmony, Pennsylvania are far more valuable because these are people that are only remembering things a few years ago and firsthand knowledge. And a lot of the Mormon apologists in the past have tried to downgrade these affidavits in various ways. And one way is that they try to say that that a lot of the Howe's Spalding affidavits have fallen by the wayside as far as scholars are concerned. They don't regard them very highly or accurately, or that they have any value whatsoever in assessing the Book of Mormon. There are a few people, of course, we know that still believe in the Spalding theory, and it's quite popular on the internet. But the professional type historians, and by and large, the largest segment of them don't regard the Spalding theory very highly. So the apologists try to use that as a wedge against the other affidavits, saying that, you know, if these aren't regarded highly, why should these other ones be regarded highly? And that they try to say that Hurlbut led his witnesses in both cases because of similar languages or phrases being used by different witnesses. But that could easily explained by the fact that he asked the same questions and they repeated the same question in their answers. But this was all published before, very soon after they were interviewed. They all had a chance to read their interviews and object, but none of them ever did.
That's fascinating information. Now, not all of the documents and affidavits actually even derive from Hurlbut. Is that correct?
Well, that's a good question. I forgot that. Although Hurlbut did interview the people in Harmony, Pennsylvania, like Isaac Hale, Joseph's father-in-law, and others, when he came back, he read that in public. And Martin Harris objected in one public meeting and said that Isaac Hale could not have signed that because he couldn't even see. And then, so that motivated Howe to double check on Hurlbut's affidavits. And so he wrote a letter to Isaac Hale, and Isaac Hale not only gave a second statement. He actually had it notarized and allowed it to be published in the Painesville Telegraph. And so these are all very valuable affidavits that people living now should read and be very familiar with and discuss. And they're, as his a historian, you can't ask for any more than to go back and interview these people. Of course, everyone has biases, and there are biases, and there are no such thing as, you know, objective reports of Joseph Smith, either pro or con. So historians are very adept at dealing with biased testimony, you know, especially in the case of Joseph Smith. So we look for multiple accounts and try to verify what they say through other sources, independent sources. And a lot of what Joseph Smith's former money-digging friends like Willard Chase, and Peter Ingersoll and William Stafford, a lot of what they said was verified by Mormon sources, like Joseph Knight Sr. is one, Oliver Cowdery himself in an indirect way. You know, Joseph Smith admitted was a money digger, but he downplayed it and tried to make it sound like it was just a one-time thing, and that he didn't mention using a seer stone, and that he was the leader of these money digging expeditions as the seer, seeing where the treasures are under the ground through his seer stone, the very same seer stone that he used to translate the Book of Mormon with. And these, so Joseph Smith tried to downplay it, and his account can be questioned through these other accounts, which are multiple and more reliable than Joseph Smith's version.
And in certain respects, too, you can point to actual believing Mormons of the time who shared some of the views of the folks who are giving these affidavits. They're the ones who are talking about a stone being placed in the hat and so on as part of the translation process. In other words, it's not just limited to one group who are the outsiders are saying one thing and another group who are the insiders are saying something completely different. Mm-hmm. In fact, on the contrary, they frequently agree with each other on some fairly critical points. But it's the idea that Joseph Smith, in distancing himself from all of this, had created essentially his own version of the story. And that's what's at odds with some of these other early tellings, or at least it obscures some of these elements. Hence, the stone and the hat becomes the Urim and Thummim, and it's transformed into something that's more palatable, perhaps.
Well, right. Joseph Smith, the Urim and Thummim story and the spectacles, the two stones in the rim of a silver bow, all of that comes later in the story. The term Urim and Thummim comes later, you know, 1831, 1832, to try to link it with the Bible, the Old Testament breastplate, Aaron's breastplate, and to distance it from the magic, folk magic, treasure-seeing context in which the Book of Mormon, coming forth of the Book of Mormon, as well as the translation of the Book of Mormon, was originally told. And it wasn't embarrassing to some of the early followers, like Joseph's father, who was a money digger also, that it spoke to him. It made sense to him. It made sense to Joseph Knight Sr., another money digging companion of Joseph Smith that later that converted to Mormonism. But when Joseph Smith found out that this story really wasn't mainstream Christian theology, to him it was. To him, there was no difference between money digging, the occult, and Christianity. He didn't have a traditional Christian position anyway. So, but when he found that it would be a barrier to conversions, then the story started transforming. He started suppressing elements of the story and started altering the story to make it more Christian sounding. It's instead of the spirit guarding the treasure, it became an angel of light. He's not hurled back from the plates by some unseen power when he tries to touch the plates, like if in an enchanted treasure situation. But in his version, he is just forbidden to touch them. So the story starts evolving and into the story that we have now, that's the mainstream story that Mormons tell converts. But like I said, it wasn't embarrassing. It didn't cause offense to the early listeners of the story. And it grew out of Joseph Smith's early money digging career. It's something that no historian can neglect, avoid, try to smooth over. It has to be dealt with honestly. I think the most honest treatment of it has been given by Mike Quinn, a believer. And of course, he's been vilified for doing that.
There are other works, I suppose, too, that are coming out from devout believers who are taking a position where they're acknowledging some of these elements. Like, for example, you know, Mike McKay and one of his associates at BYU recently published a book in which they acknowledge at quite some length that Joseph Smith's translation of the Book of Mormon involves placing a stone in the hat. And we're kind of in a different era now where you can't hide these sources or you can't ignore these sources because there's just an information overload. Folks can find things that would have been rather obscure 15 years ago. And within a few seconds on a search engine, you can locate very obscure sources and understand these events. So there's no sense in trying to cover them or to not just be forthright with a discussion of these issues.
Yes. Richard Bushman, in his biography, Rough Stone Rolling, admits the money digging, treasure digging aspect of Joseph Smith's early career and said that it did appeal to his father. Joseph Smith Sr. made it more palatable to him. So, yes, I'm glad that we are moving. Some of us, anyway, are trying to grasp who this Joseph Smith guy really was and what his history really was and not try to stick with the 1838 account, which was, you know, historians should be suspicious of an official account anyway. And I find that there's too much defensiveness of the 1838 account. I do hear little hints here and there that some are trying to let it go somewhat. But, you know, it's an apologetic history that Joseph Smith was trying to formulate there.
Great comments, Dan. One thing we should probably mention, too, is that in referring to Dr. Hurlbut, that he wasn't actually a doctor. That doctor was his given name. And one of the things that's kind of intriguing to me is when you look at the lives of these individuals who are involved in some of these early events, I often kind of visualize in my head, you know, like Ebert E. Howe being this elderly curmudgeon type of individual. And yet at the time he published Mormonism Unveiled, he was 37 years old. And Dr. Hurlbut, who you would normally associate with, you know, somebody who has gone through medical school, done their residency, of course, he did no such thing because that didn't have anything to do with his name. He was all of 25 years old when all of this was going down. And, you know, you mentioned E.B. Grandin earlier and his involvement in the publication of the Book of Mormon. And I remember when I first learned that he was 23 years old at the time all of that happened, I was just really surprised. And looking at their ages and their maturity level and so on at the time is also an interesting take that kind of makes the whole thing all that much more real. And in the case of Philastus Hurlbut, Dr. Philastus Hurlbut, it's very personal between him and Joseph. Joseph even takes him to court. And, you know, Smith is going to have Hurlbut charged because I guess there have been statements made that have been taken as direct threats on his life. Do you know much about that scandal and how that all unfolded?
A little. Hurlbut, when he joined the church, he said that if he ever learned that the Book of Mormon was false, that he would cause Joseph Smith's destruction. And he was quite heated at times in other exchanges and seems to have threatened Joseph Smith, and Joseph Smith sued him and got a restraining order, you know, against Hurlbut to stay away. So it wasn't all that much, but Joseph Smith tried to make a lot out of Hurlbut threatening his life. But Hurlbut did lose the case. He said, oh, I didn't really threaten Joseph Smith. I meant the destruction of Mormonism, not Joseph Smith. So there is that. It did get heated, and he felt like he had been fooled for a while. And the thing, though, I think to remember is that what he did doesn't really connect to the value of the affidavits he collected. Some people say, oh, he was biased and he was angry, and so therefore, you know, that's why you have these negative affidavits. And it's true that he went after looking for people who had negative views, criticisms of Joseph Smith. And he did go to the schoolhouse there in Palmyra and have people come to him. And he didn't go, and then he went out and he got some others, but he didn't go to people. At least one person complained that he didn't come to me. This is Saunders, Benjamin Saunders. He didn't come to me because he couldn't get a negative view of Joseph Smith out of me. Although, you know, Saunders was later interviewed and did give some negative views of Joseph Smith. Anyway, so it doesn't really discount the affidavits, because each of these signers are responsible for their own affidavits. None of them ever complained about being misrepresented or anything.
The animosity between Joseph Smith and Dr. Hurlbut was certainly mutual. I'm just looking here at Joseph Smith's entries in his journal, which is, interestingly enough, it's in Joseph Smith's handwriting. So this is a Joseph Smith holograph, and he writes, "The Lord shall destroy him who has lifted his heel against me, even that wicked man, Dr. P. Hurlbut. He will deliver him to the fowls of the heaven, and his bones shall be cast to the blast of the wind. For he lifted his arm against the Almighty. Therefore the Lord shall destroy him. This is something that he has taken very personal, and what I find intriguing after all this conversation that we've had about Book of Mormon origins and whether or not it reflects a 19th century worldview, is that in that short, fairly poetic curse on Hurlbut, Joseph Smith, again, I think, reveals himself as an interesting scripture maker. Because that text is actually drawn from allusions that appear in Psalms 41:9 and Psalms 79:2, and it's brought together into this new form where he's added in his own material, but he's also made it a fairly well-metered poetic presentation of a curse. And so it's interesting that we've come full circle in our discussion here from Joseph Smith and how the Book of Mormon would have been understood by a first reader, and looking at something which is designed as a curse. And you see within it the elements you see in the scripture creation that I think Joseph Smith had become accustomed to. And again, what makes this one particularly interesting is because it's actually in Joseph Smith's handwriting, and this is something that he wrote. And so it's a fascinating glimpse into his mind and his processes of thinking, but it's very clear that he took this whole thing very personally and wasn't pleased with the book or any of those who happened to be negative in their appraisal of him and his character.
Yeah, one of the odd things is that he never contradicted any of these affidavits. He did in general by calling them a bunch of lies, and that's about it. He tried to contradict the money digging thing, but he didn't do it honestly. He tried to say that there was nothing to the money thing. And it turns out that the money diggers, these affidavits, were telling the truth on that score. And it was Joseph Smith who decided to obfuscate on that issue and try not to. He never really answered it, tried to make it seem like it was something else. Oliver Cowdery, he talked about the book in The Messenger and Advocate, and he just called it a bunch of lies and never really dealt with it. So, you know, this is something that readers of Howe should keep in mind when they're reading, especially reading these affidavits.
And to a certain degree, I guess you could say that even Oliver Cowdery's 1834 history was in part precipitated by Howe's book, which gave rise to these histories being written early on. And the histories themselves, of course, take on a very nuanced evolution as time goes on, as the story is being remolded, rewritten to match later interpretations. Dan, I appreciate so much the time that you've taken out to come and do this interview. I know that this is not your favorite thing to do in the world. And I'm sitting in an office right now that I think must be around 105 degrees. And it's very hot in here today. So if I've sounded distracted at all, you'll know it's because I'm sweating profusely. But thank you so much for your friendship, for the contributions you've made to Mormon studies. And I, along with many others, I'm sure, are looking forward to your upcoming publications. And I've been telling different guests who have been coming on that I want to have them back again when they come out with their new publications. And that's becoming a mantra now. And I'd say the same to you as well. I want to get you back on here, especially after you do your multi-volume works on Wilford Woodruff and the history of the church. There's a lot more to discuss, and it would be nice to give folks more of a glimpse into what our phone conversations often turn out to be, which can be hours and hours long. And just enjoying each other's thoughts and ideas on different matters. And again, thank you so much, my friend. And I have a great deal of admiration for you. And I look forward to having you on again.
Well, thank you. I'll take you up on that maybe. And thanks for your friendship. I really enjoyed it all these years. And thanks for having me.